Chapter 47, Section 2. Labour Rent. If we consider ground rent in its simplest form, that of labour rent, where the direct producer, using instruments of labour, plough, cattle, etc., which actually or legally belong to him, cultivates soil actually owned by him during part of the week, and works during the remaining days upon the estate of the feudal lord without any compensation from the feudal lord, the situation here is still quite clear, for in this case rent and surplus value are identical. Rent, not profit, is the form here, through which unpaid surplus labour expresses itself. To what extent the labourer, a self-sustaining serf, can secure in this case a surplus above his indispensable necessities of life, that is, a surplus above that which we would call wages under the capitalist mode of production, depends, other circumstances remaining unchanged, upon the proportion in which his labour time is divided into labour time for himself and enforced labour time for his feudal lord. This surplus above the indispensable requirements of life, the germ of what appears as profit under the capitalist mode of production, is therefore wholly determined by the amount of ground rent, which in this case is not only directly unpaid surplus labour, but also appears as such. It is unpaid surplus labour for the owner of the means of production, which here coincide with the land, and so far as they differ from it, are mere accessories to it. That the product of the serf must here suffice to reproduce his conditions of labour in addition to his subsistence is a circumstance which remains the same under all modes of production, for it is not the result of their specific form, but a natural requisite of all continuous and reproductive labour in general, of any continuing production, which is always simultaneously reproduction, that is, including reproduction of its own operating conditions. It is furthermore evident that in all forms in which the direct labourer remains the possessor of the means of production and labour conditions necessary for the production of his own means of subsistence, the property relationship must simultaneously appear as a direct relation of lordship and servitude, so that the direct producer is not free. A lack of freedom, which may be reduced from serfdom with enforced labour to a mere tributary relationship. The direct producer, according to our assumption, is to be found here in possession of his own means of production, the necessary material labour conditions required for the realisation of his labour and the production of his means of subsistence. He conducts his agricultural activity and the rural home industries connected with it independently. This independence is not undermined by the circumstance that the small peasants may form among themselves a more or less natural production community, as they do in India, since it is here merely a question of independence from the nominal lord of the manor. Under such conditions, the surplus labour for the nominal owner of the land can only be extorted from them by other than economic pressure, whatever the form assumed may be. Footnote. Following the conquest of a country, the immediate aim of a conqueror was also to convert its people to his own use. Compare Lange, Théorie des lois civiles, ou Principes fondamentaux de la société, volumes 1-2, London, 1767. See also Moser, Osnabrückische Geschichte, Part 1, Berlin and Stettin. End of footnote. This differs from slave or plantation economy in that the slave works under alien conditions of production and not independently. Thus conditions of personal dependence are requisite, the lack of personal freedom, no matter to what extent, and being tied to the soil as its accessory, bondage in the true sense of the word. Should the direct producers not be confronted by a private landowner, but rather, as in Asia, under direct subordination to a state which stands over them as their landlord and simultaneously as sovereign, then rent and taxes coincide, or rather there exists no tax which differs from this form of ground rent. Under such circumstances, there need exist no stronger political or economic pressure than that common to all subjection to that state. The state is then the supreme lord. Sovereignty here consists in the ownership of land concentrated on a national scale. But on the other hand, no private ownership of land exists, although there is both private and common possession and use of land. The specific economic form in which unpaid surplus labour is pumped out of direct producers determines the relationship of rulers and ruled, as it grows directly out of production itself and, in turn, reacts upon it as a determining element. Upon this, however, is founded the entire formation of the economic community which grows up out of the production relations themselves, thereby simultaneously its specific political form. It is always the direct relationship of the owners of the conditions of production to the direct producers, a relation always naturally corresponding to a definite stage in the development of the methods of labour and thereby its social productivity, which reveals the innermost secret, the hidden basis of the entire social structure, and with it the political form of the relation of sovereignty and dependence. In short, the corresponding specific form of the state. This does not prevent the same economic basis, the same from the standpoint of its main conditions due to innumerable different empirical circumstances, natural environment, racial relations, external historical influences, etc., from showing infinite variations and gradations in appearance, which can be ascertained only by analysis of the empirically given circumstances. So much is evident with respect to labour rent, the simplest and most primitive form of rent. Rent is here the primeval form of surplus labour and coincides with it. But this identity of surplus value with unpaid labour of others need not be analysed here because it still exists in its visible, palpable form, since the labour of the direct producer for himself is still separated in space and time from his labour for the landlord, and the latter appears directly in the brutal form of enforced labour for a third person. In the same way, the attribute possessed by the soil to produce rent is here reduced to a tangibly open secret, for the disposition to furnish rent here also includes human labour power bound to the soil, and the property relation which compels the owner of labour power to drive it on and activate it beyond such measure as is required to satisfy his own indispensable needs. Rent consists directly in the appropriation of this surplus expenditure of labour power by the landlord. For the direct producer pays him no additional rent. Here, where surplus value and rent are not only identical, but where surplus value has the tangible form of surplus labour, the natural conditions or limits of rent, being those of surplus value in general, are plainly clear. The direct producer must, 1, possess enough labour power, and 2, the natural conditions of his labour, above all the soil cultivated by him, must be productive enough. In a word, the natural productivity of his labour must be big enough to give him the possibility of retaining some surplus labour over and above that required for the satisfaction of his own indispensable needs. It is not this possibility which creates the rent, but rather compulsion which turns this possibility into reality. But the possibility itself is conditioned by subjective and objective natural circumstances, and here, too, lies nothing at all mysterious. Should labour power be minute, and the natural conditions of labour scanty, then the surplus labour is small. But in such a case, so are the wants of the producers on the one hand, and the relative number of exploiters of surplus labour on the other. And finally, so is the surplus product, whereby this barely productive surplus labour is realised for those few exploiting landowners. Finally, labour rent in itself implies that, all other circumstances remaining equal, it will depend wholly upon the relative amount of surplus labour, or enforced labour, to what extent the direct producer shall be enabled to improve his own condition, to acquire wealth, to produce an excess over and above his indispensable means of subsistence, or, if we wish to anticipate the capitalist mode of expression, whether he shall be able to produce a profit for himself, and how much of a profit, that is, an excess over his wages, which have been produced by himself. Rent here is the normal, all-absorbing, so to say, legitimate form of surplus labour, and far from being excess over profit, which means in this case being above any other excess over wages, it is rather that the amount of such profit, and even its very existence, depends, other circumstances being equal, upon the amount of rent, that is, the enforced surplus labour to be surrendered to the landowners. Since the direct producer is not the owner but only a possessor, and since all his surplus labour by right actually belongs to the landlord, some historians have expressed astonishment that it should be at all possible for those subject to enforced labour, or serfs, to acquire any independent property, or, relatively speaking, wealth, under such circumstances. However, it is evident that tradition must play a dominant role in the primitive and undeveloped circumstances on which these social production relations and the corresponding mode of production are based. It is furthermore clear that here, as always, it is in the interest of the ruling section of society to sanction the existing order as law, and to legally establish its limits, given through usage and tradition. Apart from all else, this, by the way, comes about of itself as soon as the constant reproduction of the basis of the existing order and its fundamental relations assumes a regulated and orderly form in the course of time. And such regulation and order are themselves indispensable elements of any mode of production, if it is to assume social stability and independence from mere chance and arbitrariness. These are precisely the form of its social stability, and therefore its relative freedom from mere arbitrariness and mere chance. Under backward conditions of the production process, as well as the corresponding social relations, it achieves this form by mere repetition of their very reproduction. If this has continued on for some time, it entrenches itself as custom and tradition, and is finally sanctioned as an explicit law. However, since the form of this surplus labour, enforced labour, is based upon the imperfect development of all social productive powers and the crudeness of the methods of labour itself, it will naturally absorb a relatively much smaller portion of the direct producer's total labour than under developed modes of production, particularly the capitalist mode of production. Take it, for instance, that the enforced labour for the landlord originally amounted to 2 days per week. These 2 days of enforced labour per week are thereby fixed, are a constant magnitude, legally regulated by prescriptive or written law. But the productivity of the remaining days of the week, which are at the disposal of the direct producer himself, is a variable magnitude, which must develop in the course of his experience, just as the new wants he acquires, and just as the expansion of the market for his product and the increasing assurance with which he disposes of this portion of his labour power will spur him on to a greater exertion of his labour power, whereby it should not be forgotten that the employment of his labour power is by no means confined to agriculture, but includes rural home industry. The possibility is here presented for definite economic development taking place, depending, of course, upon favourable circumstances, inborn racial characteristics, etc.